Hello, I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi, and it's time for our birthdays. Teresa Sampson of Newton, happy birthday to you. Jessica Brune of Des Moines, we're sending you a big birthday shout-out today. If you share a birthday today with Teresa and Jessica and you didn't hear your name, please give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Here's a reminder that our program schedule has changed dramatically so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. Let's get back to the news by turning to today's USA Today. We'll begin with five things the editors say we need to know this Memorial Day Monday, May 31st, 2021. First, 100 years ago, Tulsa Race Massacre destroyed a community. Monday marks the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre, one of the worst incidents of racial violence in American history. A white mob's attack on the city's affluent Greenwood neighborhood, home to about 10,000 people and a business district known as Black Wall Street, left the community in ruins. While the true death toll may never be known, it is estimated that hundreds were killed and injured. A century later, the legacy of that weekend is still being felt. And after being reduced to whispers and left out of history books for decades, the victims' stories are being told. Second, Americans hit the road on a chilly Memorial Day. Memorial Day weekend, often considered the unofficial start to summer, got off to a frosty start for many in the Northeast as millions of Americans prepared to travel despite the pandemic and a rise in gas prices. However, this holiday may offer a semblance of normalcy, as CDC Director Rochelle Walensky gave the okay for vaccinated Americans to, quote, enjoy your Memorial Day, end quote. Originally known as Decoration Day, a Civil War-era tradition in which loved ones decorated the graves of soldiers at the end of May, the federal holiday now pays tribute to the fallen soldiers who died in uniform. Quote, Memorial Day shouldn't just be a day to remember, writes retired Navy SEAL Commander Mike Hayes. Quote, it should be a day to change our understanding of service, end quote. Third, search for suspects continue after Miami-area shooting leaves 2 dead and 20 injured. Authorities in South Florida are continuing to search for suspects after 2 people died and at least 20 others were injured early Sunday during a shooting outside a banquet hall. The gunfire erupted at the El Mula Banquet Hall in northwest Miami-Dade County near Hialeah, police said. 3 people came out of an SUV and opened fire on the crowd outside, Miami-Dade Police Director Alfredo Freddy Ramirez III said. Camping World CEO and TV personality Marcus Lemonis expressed his support for a search, tweeting that he was offering a $100,000 reward to help authorities, quote, arrest and convict the suspect or suspects, end quote. As of Sunday afternoon, police had not released the names of the victims. Fourth, Naomi Osaka advances and fined at French Open. The French Open continues Monday after 4-time Grand Slam champion Naomi Osaka emerged victorious in her first-round matchup against Patricia Maria Teague. Afterward, Osaka did not speak to the media, as she indicated earlier in the week. She was subsequently fined $15,000 and the French Open warned she, quote, would be exposing herself to possible further code of conduct infringement consequences, end quote. Osaka could be subject to being kicked out of the tournament and, quote, trigger of a major offense investigation that could lead to more substantial fines and future Grand Slam suspensions, end quote. Before the tournament, Osaka announced she would not be speaking to media, saying that it was a mental health issue which creates a self-doubt with players who are forced to talk to the media after a loss. The French Open resumes Monday, including a matchup featuring 7th-seeded Serena Williams, who will face Irina Carmelia Begu. And 5th, Texas Dems walk out, killing GOP elections bill. Amid national attention over Republican efforts to rewrite Texas election laws, House Democrats killed Senate Bill 7 late Sunday by walking off the floor in the middle of debate, breaking quorum, and forcing the House to adjourn. The restrictive voting bill, known as the Election Integrity Protection Act, was on the edge of Republican Governor Greg Abbott's desk before failing to pass, after Democrats walked out before a midnight deadline. Abbott swiftly said he would call a special session to again try passing the voting bill since the regular legislative session ends Monday. Before walking off the floor, Democrats had tried to derail SB 7 by raising parliamentary objections, arguing that the bill and a companion resolution needed because the measure grew substantially in a conference committee violated House rules. When those maneuvers fell short, Democrats disappeared, then forced a vote that showed only 86 House members present, short of the 100 needed for a quorum. In today's coronavirus updates compiled by Stephen Vargas and Eleanor Aspergren of USA Today, restrictions at funerals have been lifted for vaccinated individuals at the nation's 155 cemeteries dedicated to veterans, the Department of Veterans Affairs announced last week. It comes as the VA reported last Monday that there were no new COVID deaths at its medical centers throughout the country, a first since March 18, 2020. VA data shows more than 12,000 have died and more than 2.5 million have been inoculated against COVID-19 out of the roughly 9 million veterans enrolled in the agency's programs. The isolation of the pandemic has also been particularly hard on veterans, many of whom depend on kinship with fellow service members to cope with wartime trauma. Jeremy Butler, a 47-year-old Navy Reserve officer in New York who heads the advocacy group Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, told the Associated Press. Quote, "We're reuniting now, but it's been an extremely challenging year," he said. But others, especially the families of veterans who survived the horrors of war, only to die from COVID, Memorial Day can reopen barely healed wounds. In Western Massachusetts, Susan Kenney told AP the death of her 78-year-old father last April from the virus still remains raw. Charles Lowell, an Air Force veteran who served during the Vietnam War, was among 76 residents of the Holyoke Soldiers' Home who died in one of America's deadliest coronavirus outbreaks last year in a long-term care facility. Quote, "I've been reliving this for a whole year," she said, "at every milestone. Veterans Day, his birthday, his death anniversary, everything is a constant reminder of what happened. It's so painful to think about." End quote. Also in the news, a Tennessee hat seller removed an Instagram post after fueling social media controversy by selling a patch that looks like the Jewish Star of David. Hatworks, run by hatmaker Gigi Gaskins, posted a photo of a woman wearing a bright yellow star sticker with the words, quote, "not vaccinated," end quote. In a recent study published in the Journal of American Medical Association, Johns Hopkins medicine researchers studied antibody levels of solid organ transplant recipients who had gotten two shots of either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine and hadn't previously had COVID-19. Of the 658 participants in the study, 46% had no detectable antibodies to the virus that causes COVID-19 after both shots. And about half of U.S. adults are completely vaccinated against COVID-19, and cases are going down across the nation. However, the Washington Post found that the rate of hospitalizations for those who are unvaccinated is the same as it was 3 months ago, and the rate of infections for those who are unvaccinated is the same as it was in December. New York's 7-day coronavirus positivity rate has dropped to a record low of 0.71%, following 55 straight days of decline, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced Sunday. Businesses can require their employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19 and offer incentives to do so without violating federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission laws, the agency said. The updated EEOC guidance also indicates that employers must make, quote, "reasonable accommodations," end quote, for employees who don't get vaccinated because of a disability, religious beliefs, or pregnancy. Japan on Friday announced that the country's state of emergency, set to expire Monday, would be extended until June 20th, a little more than a month from the Olympic Games, which are set to be held in Tokyo. In today's numbers, the U.S. has more than 33.2 million confirmed coronavirus cases and 594,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University data. The global totals, over 170.1 million cases and 3.53 million deaths. More than 135 million Americans have been fully vaccinated, 40.7% of the population. Matthew Brown of USA Today writes, quote, "This is a hard day for us," end quote. Biden honors son Beau in Memorial Day remarks on anniversary of his death. President Joe Biden commended armed service members in Memorial Day remarks Sunday, calling those in uniform the, quote, "solid spine of this country," end quote. Quote, "As a nation, we must always remember, we must remember the price that was paid for our liberties. We must remember the debt we owe those who have paid it and the families left behind," Biden said at an event at Veterans Memorial Park at the Delaware Memorial Bridge. Memorial Day, celebrated the last Monday of the month of May, commemorates the lives of military personnel who have died while in service. Biden, whose son Beau was an Iraq War combat veteran and died after battling brain cancer in 2015, referenced loss in his address. Quote, "As many of you know, this is a hard day for us. 6 years ago today, Hunter lost his dad, and I lost my son," Biden said, referencing his grandson Hunter, who was seated next to him. Quote, "I know how much the loss hurts," Biden said. "I know the black hole it leaves in the middle of your chest. It feels like you may get sucked into it and not come out," end quote. Delaware Governor John Carney and Senator Tom Carper, a Democrat from Delaware, were also present at the event. Carper led the crowd in reciting the preamble of the Constitution before Biden's remarks. Biden also referenced his upcoming June 16th summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin and a recent conversation with Chinese President Xi Jinping, telling those present that he'd continue to stress the importance of human rights to both leaders. The service ended with a 21-gun salute amid light rain over the Delaware River. In world news, Yosef Federman of the Associated Press reports in USA Today that Netanyahu could lose prime minister job as rivals attempt to join forces. The head of a small, hardline party on Sunday said he would try to form a unity government with President Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's opponents, taking a major step toward ending the 12-year rule of the Israeli leader. In a nationwide address, Yamina party leader Naftali Bennett said he had decided to join forces with the country's opposition leader, Yair Lapid. The pair have until Wednesday to complete a deal in which they are expected to each serve 2 years as prime minister in a rotation deal. Quote, "It's my intention to do my utmost in order to form a national unity government along with my friend Yair Lapid, so that, God willing, together we can save the country from a tailspin and return Israel to its course," Bennett said. A unity government would end the cycle of deadlock that has plunged the country into 4 inconclusive elections over the past 2 years. It would also end, at least for the time being, the record-setting tenure of Netanyahu, the most dominant figure in Israeli politics over the past 3 decades. In his own televised statement, Netanyahu accused Bennett of betraying the Israeli right wing. He urged nationalist politicians who have joined the coalition talks not to establish what he called a, quote, "leftist government," end quote. Quote, "A government like this is a danger to the security of Israel and is also a danger to the future of the state," he said. Bennett, a former Netanyahu aide turned rival, said he was taking the dramatic step to prevent yet another election. While sharing Netanyahu's nationalist ideology, Bennett said there was no feasible way for the hardline right wing to form a governing majority in parliament. Quote, "A government like this will succeed only if we work together as a group," he said. He said everyone, quote, "will need to postpone fulfilling all their dreams. We will focus on what can be done instead of fighting all day on what's impossible," end quote. Each of the past 4 elections was seen as a referendum on Netanyahu, who has become a polarizing figure as he stands trial on corruption charges, with each ending in deadlock. Netanyahu is desperate to stay in power while he is on trial. He has used his office as a stage to rally support and lash out against police, prosecutors, and the media. If his opponents fail to form a government and new elections are triggered, it would give him another chance at seeing the election of a parliament that is in favor of granting him immunity from prosecution. But if they succeed, he would find himself in the much weaker position of opposition leader and potentially find himself facing unrest in his Likud party. Netanyahu, who has accused Bennett of betraying the Israeli right wing, planned a televised statement later Sunday. In order to form a government, a party leader must secure the support of a 61-seat majority in parliament. Because no single party controls a majority on its own, coalitions are usually built with smaller partners. As leader of the largest party, Netanyahu was given the first opportunity by the country's figurehead president to form a coalition, but he was unable to secure a majority with his traditional religious and nationalist ties. Netanyahu even attempted to court a small Islamist Arab party, but was thwarted by a small ultranationalist party with racist anti-Arab agenda. Although Arabs make up some 20% of Israel's population, an Arab party has never before sat in an Israeli coalition government. After Netanyahu's failure to form a government, Lapid was then given 4 weeks to cobble together a coalition. He has until Wednesday to complete the task. Lapid already faced a difficult challenge, given the broad range of parties in the anti-Netanyahu bloc that have little in common. They include dovish left-wing parties, a pair of right-wing nationalist parties, including Bennett's Yamina, and most likely the Islamist United Arab List. Lapid's task was made even more difficult after war broke out with Hamas militants in the Gaza Strip on May 10th. His coalition talks were put on hold during the 11 days of fighting. But with Wednesday's deadline looming, negotiations have kicked into high gear. Lapid has reached coalition deals with 3 other parties so far. If he finalizes a deal with Bennett, the remaining partners are expected to fall quickly into place. In other world news, Joe McDonald of the Associated Press writes, China to allow couples to have 3 children in effort to cope with aging society. China's ruling Communist Party said Monday it will ease birth limits to allow all couples to have 3 children instead of 2 in hopes of slowing the rapid aging of its population, which is adding to strains on the economy and society. The ruling party has enforced birth limits since 1980 to restrain population growth, but worries the number of working-age people is falling too fast while the share over age 65 is rising. That threatens to disrupt its ambitions to transform China into a prosperous consumer society and global technology leader. A ruling party meeting led by President Xi Jinping decided to introduce, quote, measures to actively deal with the aging population, the official Xinhua news agency said. It said they agreed that, quote, implementing the policy of one couple can have 3 children and supporting measures are conducive to improving China's population structure, end quote. Leaders also agreed China needs to raise its retirement age to keep more people in the workforce and improve pension and health services, Xinhua said. Restrictions that limited most couples to 1 child were eased in 2015 to allow 2, but the total number of births fell further, suggesting rule changes on their own have had little impact on the trend. Couples say they are put off by high costs of raising a child, disruption to their jobs, and the need to look after elderly parents. China, along with Thailand and some other Asian economies, face what economists call the challenge of whether they can get rich before they get old. The Chinese population of 1.4 billion already was expected to peak later this decade and start to decline. Census data released May 11th suggests that is happening faster than expected, adding to burdens on underfunded pension and health systems and cutting the number of future workers available to support a growing retiree group. The share of working-age people, 15 to 59 in the population, fell to 63.3% last year from 70.1% a decade earlier. The group aged 65 and older grew to 13.5% from 8.9%. The 12 million births reported last year was down nearly one-fifth from 2019. About 40% were second children, down from 50% in 2017, according to Ning Xinxi, a statistics official who announced the data on May 11th. Chinese researchers and the Labor Ministry say the share of working-age people might fall to half the population by 2050. that increases the so-called dependency ratio, or the number of retirees who rely on each worker to generate income for pension funds and to pay taxes for health and other public services. Leaders at Monday's meeting agreed it is, quote, necessary to steadily implement the gradual postponement of the legal retirement age, Xinhua said. It gave no details, but the government has been debating raising the official retirement ages of 60 for men, 55 for white-collar female workers, and 50 for blue-collar female workers. The potential change is politically fraught. Female professionals welcome a chance to stay in satisfying careers, but others, whose bodies are worn out from decades of manual labor, resent being required to work longer. The fertility rate, or the average number of births per mother, stood at 1.3 in 2020, well below the 2.1 that would maintain the size of the population. China's birth rate, paralleling trends in other Asian economies, already was falling before the one-child rule. The average number of children per Chinese mother tumbled from above 6 in the 1960s to below 3 by 1980, according to the World Bank. Demographers say official birth limits concealed what would have been a further fall in the number of children per family without the restrictions. The ruling party says it prevented as many as 400 million potential births, averting shortages of food and water. But demographers say if China followed trends in Thailand, parts of India, and other countries, the number of additional babies might have been as low as a few million. Returning to news from the U.S., Indaya Yancey Bragg writes, not just Tulsa. Racist mobs were, quote, widespread and a constant concern, end quote, 100 years ago. The anti-black mob violence that struck Tulsa in 1921 may be the most well-known, but it's not the only tragedy of its kind. Between 1917 and 1923, more than 1,100 Americans were killed in such racist attacks, according to William Tuttle, Jr., a retired professor of American Studies at the University of Kansas and author of Race Riot, Chicago in the Red Summer of 1919. That violence peaked over the course of 10 months in 1919, when more than 250 African Americans were killed by white mobs in at least 25 riots across the country. The era, dubbed the so-called Red Summer by civil rights leader James Weldon Johnson, saw the, quote, worst spate of anti-black violence in American history, said Cameron McWhirter, author of Red Summer, The Summer of 1919, and The Awakening of Black America. The bloodshed occurred during a period of racial, social, and political turmoil in the wake of World War I. Black veterans returned from the war demanding the constitutionally promised rights they'd fought for in Europe, and African Americans were migrating and competing with whites for jobs, McWhirter explained. In response, white people who sought to uphold deeply entrenched white supremacy through the Jim Crow laws of the South and de facto segregation of the North seized on opportunities to react violently. Quote, this is American history, and we need to understand it if we're going to understand our country's history going forward, McWhirter said. Quote, we need to understand that racial violence on this scale was widespread and a constant concern, end quote. The violence left deep psychological wounds and set the stage for decades of continued economic and social oppression, including policies like redlining and the contentious relationship between African Americans and the police that persists today, said David Krugler, a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. Black Americans didn't just physically resist the attacks. The NAACP emerged as the preeminent black political organization to fight legal battles, and black journalists, like Ida B. Wells, combated misinformation about the conflicts, said Krugler, author of 1919, The Year of Racial Violence, How African Americans Fought Back. More than a century later, experts say communities are beginning to acknowledge the violence, but it can be difficult to know the true scope of the damage. Quote, we don't have an accurate death count, not only because it wasn't done at the time, because in the decades that follow, the communities didn't want to draw attention to them, Krugler told USA Today. They didn't want to dig up, literally and metaphorically, the horrors of white mobs targeting African Americans. The story continues and highlights four tragedies of this era that haven't gained the same national recognition as the Tulsa Race Massacre. East St. Louis, Illinois, in 1917, where, quote, black skin was a death warrant, end quote, after cops killed. Chicago, 1919, where a teen was killed in a black neighborhood attack. Elaine, Arkansas, in 1919, where violence followed black farmers who attempted to unionize. And Rosewood, Florida, in 1923, white mob destroys black town after alleged assault. Let's dive into that fourth incident. During a particularly cold winter in the majority black town of Rosewood, a 22-year-old white woman named Fannie Taylor from a neighboring town claimed she was assaulted by a black man. Although Taylor's story was disputed by black residents, the news spread, and a posse of hundreds of men formed under the direction of the local sheriff in January 1923. As the mob, which reportedly included members of the Ku Klux Klan, searched for a suspect, they tortured, shot, and hanged a black man named Sam Carter. Days later, a shootout erupted in the community and the white mob began burning black homes and buildings as residents fled into the swamps. A 1993 report commissioned by the Florida legislature recorded 8 deaths, 6 black, 2 white, but the true total may be higher. Black residents of the town never returned. In 1994, the state legislature approved reparations payments for survivors and created a scholarship that has been given to hundreds of students. And Iowa has made national news in this article from the Associated Press written by Thomas Beaumont and Anthony Izaguirre, titled, quote, "Partisan Intimidation," end quote. Iowa officials' resignation raises fears of politicized local election offices. It had been 8 years since a Republican candidate even stepped forward to challenge Democrat Roxana Moritz as the top elections official in Scott County, Iowa. Running unopposed in 2016 and 2020, Moritz had become, over her 4 terms as auditor, the top vote-getter ever in this swing voting county along the Mississippi River, the 3rd most populous in the state. Moritz's abrupt resignation last month came after months of tension that degenerated into personal attacks and threats of violence. Her departure and partisan moves since then are signs that an office long viewed as nonpartisan is now fair game in the political fight about trust in the nation's elections. Quote, "We took a lot of crap in my office, all of us," Moritz said in an interview, describing angry, sometimes threatening calls from the public, accusing her of fixing the 2020 election. Quote, "It was all partisan intimidation," end quote. Republicans who control the Scott County Board of Supervisors said politics played no part in their criticism of Moritz's handling of a county finance matter last year that led to calls from voters for her resignation. She is accused of falsifying working hours for poll workers to justify paying them more before the June 2020 primary, when the coronavirus pandemic made it difficult to recruit help. The state auditor, Democrat Rob Sand, is investigating. But the issue festered with a number of Republican voters in Scott County who were upset with the outcome of the presidential election nationally, even though Republican Donald Trump handily won Iowa over Democrat Joe Biden in his bid for a second term. Moritz said she and her team were subject to a stream of verbal harassment by phone, email, and social media, from name-calling to physical threats before and after last year's election. Quote, "Someone said they were going to come down and burn our building down," she said. "It was 3 weeks before the election, and we took it seriously." Election administration, long viewed as quiet and nonpartisan, is now contentious, given Trump's persistent and false claims that widespread fraud cost him re-election. Trump and his allies, in their failed bid to challenge his loss, filed multiple lawsuits to slow down the formal vote certification process. Trump praised 2 Republicans on a Detroit area election board for temporarily blocking the county's election results, in which Biden won by more than a 2-to-1 margin. As part of their nationwide effort to roll back access to the ballot, Republicans' state lawmakers have pushed legislation to impose fines or criminal penalties on election officials for violating rules. In Iowa, officials now face a fine of up to $10,000 for a so-called technical infraction of election rules as part of a new law. The current reality has led election workers to quit or retire, or has made this line of work unpalatable. In Scott County, the GOP-controlled board appointed a Republican who is a former Davenport alderwoman as the new county auditor. The board opted against a special election out of concern for its cost and efficiency, said the chairman, Ken Beck. Quote, "There was nothing political about this. An appointment is allowed by law," he said. Quote, "I didn't think it was worth the money to have such a small percent of the electorate turn out. Is that a fair election?" End quote. Now let's turn to the opinion page of today's Des Moines Register. At the top of the page is a Your Turn Guest column written by Joy Neal Kidney, the author of Leora's Letters, the story of love and loss for an Iowa family during World War II, the story behind the brothers on the Dallas County Freedom Rock. All five served, only two came home. Her column is titled, Around the World, We Honor Our War Dead. From Manila to Perry, ritual recalls sacrifice. Memorial Day is the only day set aside each year to honor and remember America's war casualties. Some of the most compelling rites are held in our cemeteries overseas, where locals will flock to commemorate the young Americans who liberated their homelands. Those on the other side of the international dateline will be the first to hold Memorial Day ceremonies. I think of Dale Wilson, whose name is chiseled on the wall of remembrance at the Manila American Cemetery, along with the five others who were with him when their B-25 crashed on a mission. They have never been found. Dale was the first of my grandparents' three sons who were lost during World War II. I think of the observances held hours later in eastern France, where another of Clabe and Leora Wilson's sons is buried in Lorraine American Cemetery in Plot D, Row 5, Grave 7. He is only one of more than 10,000 graves of Americans who lost their lives in the European theater of war. 4 years ago, I logged onto my computer to find a photo of Danny Wilson's cross, along with his photo and flowers. Matthew Carré, a Frenchman and World War II reenactor with a real heart for these young Americans, had posted it on Facebook. He was as glad to contact the family of one of the boys buried far from home as I was heartened by his kind gesture. That December, Yvonne Steenkiste from Belgium joined Matthew for a photo at Dan Wilson's grave. What a blessing to find it early one morning. Steenkiste is active in making sure the memories of the Battle of the Bulge are kept alive on the Chaumont Ardennes, Belgium Facebook page. Lorraine Cemetery is filled with American casualties of that terrible time. Julien Pierre Schneider, the mayor of a nearby town, regularly takes schoolchildren to Danny Wilson's grave to tell his story, to remember his service and sacrifice. He also tells them about Dan Wilson's family in America, who are glad that French schoolchildren know about a young Iowa farmer who became a P-38 pilot. One early morning during Memorial Day weekend, I won't be surprised if a photo from France is waiting, reminding me that the Americans who pledged their lives to help liberate Europe from tyranny aren't forgotten. That Danny Wilson from Dallas County, Iowa, is not forgotten. Hours later, as our Earth spins in space, rites will be held in Violet Hill Cemetery in Perry. Legionnaires will remember another brother, Junior Wilson, who was killed in Texas when the engine of his fighter plane exploded in formation training. They will also pay tribute to Dale and Daniel Wilson, whose cenotaph sits just north of their brothers in Violet Hill Cemetery. Each Memorial Day, Legionnaires mark the graves with small American flags, red paper poppies, and sprigs of evergreen. The red poppy has been a symbol of war losses since Dr. John McCrae wrote the poignant poem In Flanders Fields During the First World War. Crepe paper poppies are offered for donations for wounded veterans. For decades, Leora Wilson, with her compelling connection to the victims of war, was a favorite poppy lady in Guthrie Center. Memorial Day is set aside once a year to reflect on and honor our war casualties. Take your children to a cemetery in your local cemetery, to a ceremony in your local cemetery, explaining to them why it matters. Visit a Freedom Rock and talk about why those depicted are honored. Give a donation for a red paper poppy for remembrance. We here at home must not forget their service and sacrifice. In today's letters to the editor, Carl Schilling of Des Moines writes, "Some cases shouldn't be in juvenile court." The Register published a story May 24th on efforts to extend the age for an offender to be tried as a juvenile to 21 or 25. What comes to mind immediately is that if the age for juveniles were 25 already, the trial for the slaying of Molly Tibbetts would be in juvenile court as the defendant was 24 at the time of her death. If found guilty, life without parole would be off the table. The family would face the specter of parole hearings over and over again. The minimum age for becoming a police officer in Iowa is 18. Could a young police officer charged with using unnecessary force leading to severe injury or death be trialed in juvenile court? A 25-year-old embezzler could apply for work at a bank knowing his conviction was sealed. The premise of the push to raise the age for juvenile court comes from valid information that the frontal lobes of the brain involved in such things as impulse control aren't fully developed until age 26. Okay, but I do think it is a mistake to take a giant leap from that fact to the belief that anyone under 26 should not be considered fully responsible for his or her actions. One does not have to be 26, or a teenager for that matter, to know that crime is bad. Judges should be allowed to take youth, seriousness of the crime, and other issues into consideration in sentencing, but juvenile court should be reserved for juveniles. Signed, Kurt Carl Schilling of Des Moines. Anna Meyer of Des Moines writes, 3 cheers for the Papa John Sculpture Park audio tour. If you haven't taken advantage of this very free, very excellent resource, what you'll discover when you dial the Papa John Sculpture Park audio tour phone number is a soft-spoken, eager voice guiding you to take a closer look and inviting you to see the bigger picture. For example, you'll learn that the slightly terrifying spider sculpture is actually inspired by the blessed relationship between Louise Bourgeois and her mother. Or you'll examine Deborah Butterfield's horses and understand how her artwork is a marriage of her passions. Parenthetical comment, fun extra, if you go there at the right time, you may find a bird's nest burrowed in the bones. Close paren. You find that to understand Ai Weiwei's iron tree trunk, you have to reflect on the weighted history of China's great leap forward. I'd come to realize these sculptures we often pass by and pose next to are so loved yet so unfamiliar, and I think it's a great gift to learn more about what we love. So I recommend you take a minute the next time you're in the area. Go to the park, settle on a bench, and call in. At some point, we all find ourselves squished between Grand and Locust at Papa John, a gorgeous, obscure park. It's where retired folks come in the middle of the afternoon for a daily wander. It's where kids roll down hills. It's the gift of art that isn't so much meant to be looked at as much as it is meant to be lived with. Signed, Anna Meyer of Des Moines. Nancy Brown of Urbandale writes, the best explanation for the vote on a January 6th commission. So the Republicans voted against investigating their own party's collusion with the January 6th events. Well, what a surprise that is. They voted against impeaching Donald Trump for the same reason. Impeaching Trump would have been an admission of the collusion of his supporters in Congress. My opinion is that the Republicans have just admitted to their own guilt in the government coup attempt, and that the only ones left to hold them accountable are the Democrats and Independents. May the truth be shown and the dissidents be punished. Signed, Nancy Brown of Urbandale. Today's editorial cartoon, drawn by Andy Marlette of the USA Today Network, shows 4 drawings, each with a caption. The first shows a man in uniform handing a flag to a visibly grieving woman. The caption, "May we remember." The next shows a child wearing dog tags, presumably those of a lost relative. The caption, "As deeply." The next drawing shows an elderly couple looking at a photograph of a young man in uniform. The caption, "As those." The next man shows a soldier in uniform kneeling at a grave with an American flag in front of it, and the caption, "Who can't forget." Today's opinion page in the Register also includes a column by syndicated columnist Leonard Pitts Jr., a columnist for the Miami Herald. His column on this Memorial Day is titled, "A Vietnam Vet Named Greg Taught Me the Cost of Living." It's not every day you interview someone who tells you he wants to kill himself. He was a Vietnam veteran named Greg, a man with haunted eyes and a soft voice filled with the horror of his experience. The jungle rot, the lost friends, the children rigged to explode when an unsuspecting GI scooped them up. Greg limped from an old leg wound and was fighting doctors who wanted to amputate. But his real battle was in his mind and soul. Greg simply couldn't adjust to being back in the, quote, world, end quote. The sight of an Asian face on the street, the pop of firecrackers, a traffic helicopter chopping through the sky were enough to drop him back into that jungle hell. He said he couldn't take it anymore. He was at his breaking point. Quote, "The last couple of weeks," he said, "I've come here to where I've been seriously considering killing myself, end quote. Despair seemed to roll off the man in waves. Quote, I don't see any hope, he told me. There are few things that make you feel as utterly unsuited to the moment as hearing someone confess a desire to take his own life. I hadn't bargained for this. It was 1985. A musician named Paul Hardcastle had a hit called 19, a techno-pop dance song about the war, and I had simply gone to a vet center in Los Angeles to get a soldier's perspective. With Greg, I got that and then some. I don't remember how I responded when he mentioned suicide. I'm sure I babbled about seeking help, getting to the other side of pain. Greg wasn't having it. Quote, that's what got me this far, he said in that whispery voice of his. Quote, but now those answers aren't doing it for me. My thing was that, not just the guys I knew, but for the 58,000 that got blown away or that are missing, they deserve better than for me to just give up. But now, I kind of feel like they were the lucky ones. It's like being back in the corner and I don't know which way to go, and the right way isn't working. And I've tried the right way for so long. I think the only thing that's kept me really from doing something like killing myself so far is because I don't want to be that bad example. I don't want to go against what I've been advocating all this time. End quote. Besides, he said, quote, it takes a lot of guts to kill yourself, to me. And I just haven't got the guts yet. End quote. Quote, yet. End quote. That word hammered me. For a few years, I would periodically check in with Greg to make sure he was okay. But after a while, we lost touch. The other day, I thought of him for the first time in years and decided to see if I could find any trace of him online, find out if, quote, yet, end quote, ever came. For vets, it comes all too often. In 2018, they had a suicide rate of 27.5 per 100,000, almost twice the national rate, which suggests that for all the wounds of bone and flesh that are sustained in war, perhaps the most insidious are those of mind and soul. I stumbled upon an interview he gave in 2007, so as of that date at least, quote, yet, end quote, had not yet come, which gives me hope that maybe it never did or will. On Memorial Day, we honor those who sacrificed their lives in America's wars. This year, though, I'll also be thinking of Greg and all those like him, keeping unwilling company with demons of sorrow and despair. Surely it's a bitter thing to die, but sometimes it is not much easier to live. Again, this is the opinion of syndicated columnist Leonard Pitts. The opinion section of USA Today includes a column written by Marcus Anthony Hunter, an opinion contributor, titled, Racial Discrimination Has Cost American Economy Trillions. Tulsa Massacres Just a Start. Truth, reconciliation, and acknowledgement that black financial loss in Tulsa and beyond affects the entire nation is key to repair. Racism is costly. In fact, a recent Citigroup report estimated that racial discrimination has cost the American economy $16 trillion. Most notably, the report identifies a substantial $13 trillion loss in potential business revenue because of racial discrimination in lending to black entrepreneurs and black businesses. Although these figures are estimates for the last two decades, they point to a repeated pattern of costly preventable violence, financial and physical, against non-white people in America. When a black community in America is destroyed, America's progress is destroyed. For black America, the economic losses are very direct. The wage gap, for example, puts the highest average earnings for black men at more than $20,000 less than it is for white men. But economic struggles in the black community trickle down in ways that are less obvious, but certainly not less meaningful, to non-black members of society. A close in the wealth gap over the past 20 years would have meant $2.7 trillion more spent on cars, clothes, and other goods, services, and investments that would have supported jobs for everyone. Indeed, 100 years later, the story of the Tulsa Massacre remains relevant for identifying racism's true and lasting costs. The lessons and events of this horrific episode provide powerful insights into how acknowledging the effects, costs, and destruction of systemic racism is key to healing and repairing the nation today. Born of the ingenuity of black migrants, Tulsa's Greenwood community was a bustling and dynamic black financial district in the heartland of the American Southwest. Before the massacre, that approximately 35-block Wall Street community was worth $1 million, the equivalent of $15 million today. Rather than bask in the glory of the success of Black Wall Street, white leaders, businessmen, and residents guided by fear, hatred, and a readily believed racist trope that turned out to be, by most accounts, untrue, that a black male, in this case a 19-year-old, had attacked a white 17-year-old female, saw to it that a mosaic of terror befell the neighborhood by spring 1921. White mobs looted hundreds of homes and burned down others. Some black families escaped, but an estimated 300 members of the community were killed. Fires burned from the night of May 31st well into the next day. Little to no property, bank accounts, keepsakes, or family heirlooms survived, generating a pattern of loss, death, and trauma that endures today. So how do we get beyond those traumatic losses? Representative Barbara Lee, a Democrat from California, and Senator Cory Booker, a Democrat from New Jersey, are among those calling for a national truth, racial healing, and transformation commission that will, at the least, force things that have been previously hidden into the light. The Tulsa massacre was ignored by the local government for decades. In a perfect world, the commission will set the nation on the road to racial and financial recovery. We must seize this historic opportunity to achieve a future in which the false notion of a racial hierarchy is finally obliterated. The commission seeks to properly memorialize, archive, mitigate, and prevent harms and violence like the massacres in America that didn't begin or end with Tulsa. That's complementary to existing calls for reparations for African Americans, long heralded by the late Representative John Conyers and now advanced by Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, a Democrat from Texas, in H.R. 40, a bill that would establish a commission to study the history of discrimination and avenues for repair. Perhaps we can look to South Africa for an example, even if an imperfect one, of how commissions can acknowledge hurt, make victims financially whole, and help a nation collectively move forward. The process included gruesome testimony that took 7 years and included stories of violence, rape, and murder from 2,000 people of the apartheid era, some of whom committed acts of violence, others who were victims. The commission surely helped the nation avoid genocide and massive brutality in apartheid's aftermath. The solution included payments to each victim's family that totaled $85 million. Not everyone was happy with the final outcome, but it was a step in the right direction, and it started with the acknowledgement that horrible human atrocities happened. Testimony from the victims and descendants of the Tulsa massacre and every other recorded massacre in our nation's history is vital. It has the potential to not only right the ship, but also move the nation forward with a newfound awareness of how and why racism's influence hinders our collective prosperity and solidarity. Black activists and leaders on the ground have worked tirelessly to restore, repair, and replenish the Greenwood District. This work has not been easy, but it's necessary. The loss of a financial district anywhere in America is a financial threat and loss for all Americans. Understanding that is the key to racial healing, racial equity, and a more prosperous, inclusive future. All of our lives, regardless of ethnic background and economy, depend on it. Again, this is the opinion of Marcus Anthony Hunter, a sociology and African American studies professor at UCLA, who is the author of several books, including Chocolate Cities, The Black Map of American Life. Among the opinions in USA Today are also one written by Mike Hayes, who served as commanding officer of SEAL Team 2 and oversaw all special operations in southeastern Afghanistan in 2012. He is a former National Security Council Director of Defense Policy and Strategy for Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, author of the 2021 leadership memoir, Never Enough, and founder of the 1162 Foundation to support the families of special operators who gave their lives in service. His column is titled, Find Your Own Ways to Serve to Honor the Fallen on Memorial Day. As I prepared to head to southeastern Afghanistan to lead SEAL Team 2 in 2012, I had an idea of what I could do to thank my team for their service. Find babysitters. Partnering with the Navy SEAL Foundation, we offered 10 monthly, so-called use or lose babysitting hours to spouses navigating the stress of solo parenting and worrying about their loved ones in combat. Today, on Memorial Day, when people say, quote, thank you for your service, end quote, It's a beautiful way to tip their cap to the 1.2 million people actively serving in the armed forces or our 20 million veterans. But it's also insufficient. Memorial Day shouldn't just be a day to remember. It should be a day to change our understanding of service. It should be a day to realize that we are no different from the rest of you. We possess no special gift that makes us uniquely able to give back. We should not just be thanked for our service. We should be joined. The pain of survivors on Memorial Day. I've buried far too many friends and teammates to enjoy Memorial Day as America's big barbecue. It's emotional. I served 20 years as a Navy SEAL, and most of the memories are beautiful. Pride, camaraderie, and brotherly love that will last a lifetime. But there is also an indescribable weight. The sound of bagpipes, however well-intended, reflexively transports me back to Little Creek Chapel or Arlington National Cemetery. Dozens of painful services there, year after year, the price of service for those who survive it. It gets worse. My friend's daughter screaming that her dad promised he would come home. So many losses that hardly a week goes by without seeing the face of a fallen friend on social media, or a soldier, sailor, airman, or marine I didn't know, but whose family's pain I can too easily imagine. The sacrifice is especially hard on spouses and children. They don't know the risk their loved one faces at any given moment, so they imagine the worst. Those of us in the service know intimately well that service isn't just a noun, it's a verb, too. The best way the 310 million Americans who have not served in the military can honor the fallen is to find your way to serve. Not everyone is called to serve in the way we do. The physical demands were exacting, and the emotional costs worse. 7 deployments, 10 relocations, countless months away from family, and life and death risk too frequent. Everyone is endowed with unique gifts and their own combination of skills, abilities, and interests. We are each called to use those unique gifts to pull others up in whatever way makes best sense. People often ask me what lessons from the SEALs apply to the pandemic. It's simple. We don't think in absolutes. We think relatively. In a true team, not everyone is having the same hard day. Some people are having a relatively better day, while some are relatively worse. No matter how hard things get, the teammates who are relatively up help those who are relatively down. Said differently, when you're having a bad day, just go find someone who is having a worse day and help. Pulling others up pulls us up. Service can be nurturing the elderly or mentoring the young. It can be improving our forests, cleaning our beaches or roadways, or helping prepare our precious planet for future generations. Does someone in your family need help? Is a neighbor silently crying out? Maybe not in words, but you sense the need? Perhaps more importantly, in our disconnected world, should you reach out to a struggling citizen you've never met but who needs you badly? You can shy away or have a profound impact on their life. Most important, service requires patience. It demands open-mindedness to views that might not match your own. We don't all agree, and we shouldn't. But service doesn't mean judgment. It means putting aside ego. It means shedding our biases. We need to critically consider alternate viewpoints and weigh real data and information. We need to be humble. Admit mistakes and let go. Helping others can be a window into self-discovery that can challenge our preconceptions and teach us where we were wrong. Admitting those mistakes and unshackling ourselves from our biases can be surprisingly liberating. We need to celebrate our differences and understand that they make us stronger. Service requires tolerance and respect when outcomes don't match our own wishes. One of my lieutenants surprised me by quietly asking permission for his platoon to spend an afternoon visiting kids at the local cancer ward. Sunday afternoon, their only day off. They'd been on the road training 18-hour days, 6 days a week for 6 weeks to prepare for the rugged mountains of Zabul Province in December. Great leadership. The team wanted to do it, and I knew it would bring them together. So he surprised me again with his deflated call afterward. An Army unit was already there. Same kids, same hospital. They didn't really need us, the lieutenant told me. That threw me. How were 2 out-of-town units visiting the same children? Simple. Service begets service, but you don't see that until you live it. Yes, Memorial Day is absolutely about remembering and honoring the fallen. Our fallen heroes fell to make this nation greater. The best way to honor their service is to mirror it. Serve each other. You can begin this morning. What real action can you take to improve our country and the lives of our fellow countrymen. What will you do? Again, this is the opinion of Mike Hayes. USA Today also includes an opinion written by Dustin Hall, a Chief Master Sergeant in the United States Air Force. He writes, "I'm deployed in the Middle East, but my wife has an even more difficult job at home." Memorial Day, a holiday that honors the sacrifices, service, and history of the men and women in the U.S. military, is actually the culmination of Military Appreciation Month. Designated by Congress over two decades ago, the month of May is an opportunity for Americans to show their gratitude to those who serve, have served, or have lost their lives for their country. But while many express thanks to members of the military both at home and abroad, many of us in uniform are thinking of another great service to our country, that of our military spouses. I have been deployed in the Middle East for nearly a year, my longest time away from home, my two children, and my wife Sarah. While my fellow service members and I face and overcome our own daily challenges in the field, I believe that our families and loved ones have a much more difficult job. Needless to say, a life of service is tough, but there is a sense of control that makes it that much more manageable. We have set routines, direct orders, and a structured environment. There's not a lot of left and right. What's more, we have the support and help of others within our formations. For Sarah, every day presents a new unpredictability with no higher-up telling her what to do, and she must manage largely on her own. Going through the turmoil alone. Last June, amid the panic, questions, and lockdown orders, my family was packing up to move from California to a home in Texas. I was able to spend 1 week with Sarah and the kids before saying goodbye. It is hard to look back on the last year and believe what they faced since then. In the outside world with the pandemic backdrop, we saw the country go through social unrest and political upheaval. Texas experienced a historic ice storm that devastated homes and lives. At home, while Sarah balanced her responsibilities with homeschooling, grocery shopping, and keeping the house running, my oldest was diagnosed with appendicitis, and the youngest broke a finger. Then, like hundreds of thousands of other Americans, Sarah tested positive for COVID-19. With all the changes both inside and out of our family life, Sarah has been the glue that keeps us together. Overcoming the virus is an accomplishment in and of itself, but she's done much more than words can say. A life of service is rewarding, bringing with it honor and respect. It also brings challenges unimaginable to the general public, and that rings just as true for military families. The traditional hardships faced by military-connected men and women, such as issues related to permanent change of station, PCS, and deployment orders, job instability, and access to childcare and health services, have been exacerbated by the pandemic. A mother's kind of leadership. The most recent annual Military Family Lifestyle Survey from Blue Star Families found that nearly half of military spouses reduce their work hours in order to balance their jobs with supporting their children's education. The majority of families with special needs children lost the support they needed due to closures. And over half of military families who saw a deployment during the pandemic faced an unanticipated extension of their time apart. All this while facing one of the biggest military family struggles that was largely eroded due to the pandemic, having a sense of belonging to their community. While my children are still young, I know they will look back soon and see how much their mother has done for them. She has taught them to respect other men, women, and each other. She has shown a kind of leadership even the military cannot teach. Sarah is a retired veteran of the Air Force herself. She will always be the first to tell you that she's just one of thousands of military spouses, significant others, or however service members choose to define their loved ones and families. I call her the best airman in the family. Her support, love, respect, and strength are what keeps us together, and that rings true for military spouses everywhere. We can't do our jobs without them. Again, this is the opinion of Dustin Hall, a Chief Master Sergeant in the United States Air Force. And that's it for our second hour of the Register on IRIS. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.